This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
So what we're walking on is a mound that was here when we came onto the site, which is basically farm rubble that's all been pushed into a heap. We've tried to start planting it up with wildflowers and things and to make it a bit more of a welcoming space because it's the highest point on the farm and a great way to get quite an incredible view of the farm, but also of Fife and the Forth.
There's two magpies flying just above the wood there. You can hear them chattering. Crammond Island sticking out into the Firth of Forth. Probably snow or rain over the Ockles. You can see the sort of third crossing across there. I mean, it is a fantastic yeah. vista right the way up Fife Coast and what have you.
Yeah.
And the place to enjoy that fantastic view across the Firth of Forth is Lauriston Agroecology Farm, which sits north of Edinburgh in between Crammond and Lauriston Castle. This close to the centre of Edinburgh, it should be covered in houses, but it's not. And it's now home to what's believed to be the UK's largest urban farm. I'm Mark Stephen. In this edition of Scotland Outdoors, I meet one of the people behind the project, Lisa Houston. Lisa gave me the grand tour and showed me some of the projects which they've established. And the idea is to get local people involved, not just in, you know, getting your hands into the dirt, but understanding how food is produced. But before we get to all that, how on earth did they get their hands on this prime spot?
So it's 100 acres. Certainly when we started, it was the largest urban farm in the UK.
Yeah.
I think now there's a couple of a similar scale in Manchester, maybe, but there should be more. So in 2019, a couple of friends of mine approached Edinburgh Council and said, we think you should give us that 100 acres for a food and biodiversity project. And much to everybody's shock, the council said, that's a good idea, make us a proposal.
Seriously?
Yeah. It wasn't the response we were expecting. Yeah. There was four of us at the time started working together to develop a business plan, do community consultation, and COVID hit, right? So everything slowed down at the council. But it gave us a bit of time to do some online consultation with other farms so that by the end of 2020, we were able to submit to the council a full business plan and a community consultation that had had over 1,000 responses, the majority of which were very excited. We got the lease approved in May 2021, and then you've got to get the permissions and the funding and blah, blah. So really we got on site properly at the very beginning of 22. The whole site is designed around three main themes, which are food, community and biodiversity. And it's also sort of zoned that way. So those three themes are true for the whole site, but then we also have it zoned. So you're in the community area. When we were bargaining with the council, they said, oh, do you think you could do allotments? There's, you know, a 10,000 people waiting list for allotments. It would be good if you put in allotments. And so we kind of, when we did the business plan at the time, we just sort of drew a square and went, right, that'll be the allotments. But then once we started being on site, and you can see the tower blocks of Muir House there on one side, and then we know we've got the kind of leafy suburbs of Barnton and Crammond on the other, there was a realisation that if we were just to go, hey, everybody, we've got allotments, who wants one? You might get loads of folk who've already got gardens, who have much easier access to green spaces, and the folk who've maybe not had access to those things, they might think, I'd like an allotment, but I don't have the confidence to do it because I've never had a chance to experience food growing. So instead of doing the usual way of managing the allotment, we said you have to be a group of at least three households from the local area, or an organisation working with local people in the local area.
Oh.
And it felt like a bit of a social experiment, but it's been really nice. There's a corner plot here, which is the one, so I run open gardening sessions once, twice a week, And I also teach people how to, you know, do courses in how to grow your own food or seed saving. And that's because we wanted a plot that was like, everybody can come, it's open to everybody. But then after that, what you're seeing is, so each year we've opened up 10 or 15 allotments to groups and organisations. So we've got a plot up here, which is a group of over 50-year-olds from Muirhouse and Pilton, who basically didn't know each other, had never grown food before, and put a sign up at one of the local community centres saying, do you want to get together and grow some food together? And they've been brilliant. There's a group further up, which is mostly people from Kenya who are living in Granton. This is a group who got together after the first year that I taught the how to grow your own food courses. They were like, well, now we need an allotment. You've just taught us how to grow food. So people from two of the courses basically got together and said, shall we share an allotment?
Where are you getting things like the mulch from?
We buy it in bulk because we're promoting no dig on the allotments. So rather than...
Why? Explain that.
Because it's better for the soil, the health of the soil and the biodiversity of the soil.
Right.
We don't insist on it, but we just sort of have a gentle propaganda scheme. And if we provide the compost and the wood chip and the topsoil... And also, when the council opens up allotments, they plough up the whole field. Oh. We've not done that. So if you're coming to a site and all there is grass, like when you get a new plot, what you basically get is a plot of grass.
Mm-hmm.
The easiest way to convert that into growing space is to do no dig, because you lay down cardboard, you put your topsoil on top of it, compost on top of that, and then you're
good to go.
You're good to go. So whereas if you're digging, that's an awful lot of work.
Even at this time of year, you've got leeks, onion sets in, there were chard back there, I saw herbs, there's all sorts of strawberry plants, you name it.
I think if you plan well enough, you can... There's actually some people have done a really remarkable job at growing through the winter. This coriander, so this is seeds, this is the Kenyans. Fanaka is the name of their group. And they have this brilliant coriander seed, and this is all self-seeded, and it's really, really, really fragrant.
It's really tasty, actually.
We've got a Ukrainian group, a Polish group, a group from Hong Kong, a group from South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Then we've got groups of neighbours that are from mixed background. Right? We've got somebody from Ecuador. We've got people from France. I mean, it's a really nice mixture, which means you get a very diverse...
International.
Crops, right? So it's very... And it's cool, this sort of exchange between people. But what's that you're growing? What do you do with that?
See, you know, situation like this, what I would want to do is to say, right, we're going to have a day and we want you to, you know, cook a Ukrainian dish. We want you to cook a Kenyan dish. We want you to blah, 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 and everybody share.
Yeah, we do that.
Ah! He was me thinking I was being innovative.
No, afraid not.
Well, not for the first time.
This is a pond that some volunteers from Edinburgh Uni dug for us. It's never been lined, so that would suggest
interesting.
We've got quite a lot of... quite a lot of clay in our soil.
Yeah, it does.
But it's also indicative of how much rain we've had this year.
Yeah.
The clay from here built that kitchen over there.
All right, okay.
Well, it's still in the process, but we...
Ah, right. You've got cob walls.
Cob walls. We did a workshop in August with Edinburgh Tool Library, where we built the frame, and then all the walls, we created a sort of... Watch it, it's very slippy here.
Okay.
We created a lattice work of willow and hazel inside these panels. And then we wrapped clay from the pond and straw from the wheat around the lattice work. And then now we're at the stage of starting to put some finishes on it.
And they're built into the wall so you can see the glass.
Yeah, so and then, I mean, there's a tarp on the far side at the moment, but once that comes off, you'll get a lot of light coming in.
That's a lovely idea.
Yeah, but also it's been fun. We've had like over 70 volunteers help do it all, so it's kind of nice way as well of people learning. I mean, one day it'd be nice to get some solar energy or something on it, but we don't have the budget for that yet.
Wood-burning pizza oven, that kind of thing.
That's going there. That's happening.
Oh, it's outside. I tell you, I should have been here earlier.
There's some master's students from Edinburgh University who are doing their architect's master's, and that space there is where the earthen oven's going to go. And that's the mud for the earthen oven.
You can see how clay-rich that mud is.
Yeah, can't you?
That is mud.
Look at that, it's not moving anywhere.
Really heavy.
So this kitchen was part of an Edinburgh Community Climate Fund bid that we put in, where the community voted for which projects should get it, and so we got some money to do this kitchen and the two sheds, because we don't let allotment holders have their own shed. It's all communal sheds.
Really?
Yeah.
A deliberate policy. You force people to talk to one another.
Yeah. the idea that allotment holders could then, you know, grow stuff, cook it together, eat together, but also so that other groups in the area, like folk who don't have much access to green spaces, if they want to just come, have a cup of tea, make a pot of soup, we'll put raised beds around here. So if they're not up for the responsibility of an allotment, they can come and potter about with them.
Okay. The production team take the mickey out of me because they say I'm mildly obsessed by toilets.
Oh yeah, we've
you've
very
got a composting.
One, yeah.
You've got a very fine composting toilet across there. State of the art.
Yeah.
Modern stuff.
There's basically a big bath underneath there with baskets in it to catch the solids.
Aye.
The idea is that this sends air down that helps to dehydrate and dry out, and the heat that this is black, so that heat.
Okay.
It absorbs heat to help with the absorption. And
effectively, you have a chimney at the back,
yeah,
that's made of a sort of heavy-duty plastic, etc. And there's a vent at the top that's going round and around just with the wind and what have you. So that's sucking air in. The sun is actually heating up the air inside that black chimney, going down underneath.
Yes, exactly. Well done.
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
So out with the allotments, I see you've done a fair bit of tree planting.
Yeah, we've planted, I think, to date, we've planted over 12,000 trees.
Uh-huh.
And most of that's native woodland, but we also have an orchard.
Mm-hmm.
So we have an orchard group, which is local residents who've helped to plan and plant and are caring for it. These trees that are in the wire frames are all a whole lot of different varieties of apples.
Uh-huh.
And the idea is that once they start producing fruit, it's open, so anybody can take it. This space that we've got here with the benches and the wee gazebo. So we use this space for events.
You've got a sedum roof on the gazebo.
Sedum roof on the gazebo. 2 years in a row we've had big harvest festivals here.
That's
where we've had kind of hundreds of people coming to share food and performances and music and parades and all kinds of things.
Yeah.
One of the interesting facts about this piece of land is the reason this hasn't been developed is the castle. So we're right in front of Lauriston Castle. We found out when we came on site is that the land was owned by families, mm-hmm, and then in the 60s, I think, they handed it over to the council, the family that had it previously. And basically there's some kind of 16th century title deed that declares that the Lord's view from the castle across to Fife shall not be blocked.
So they couldn't build on it.
Yeah, and they still take it completely seriously because right from the start of all our conversations with the council, they go, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Now, you do know about the Lord's view. There's no Lord. In the summertime, the castle's trees are already massive, but that has kept it safe all this time.
I did wonder because, you know, it did seem to be an incredible act of generosity, particularly, you know, in a nice area, the outskirts of Edinburgh, 100 acres, just handing it over to the community. I thought there must be a story behind that. That's brilliant.
It is good.
You obviously have room for expansion.
Yes. About a third of the land is earmarked just for habitat creation.
Okay.
But then our food production for sale, which is where the market garden is, currently we've got 20 acres in deer fence over there. We've not yet got that all under production, but the idea is that within 5 years we will. So that's going to include vegetable production, fruit production, grain growing, some field scale crops, and we also have a number of other enterprises down there, rice mushrooms.
Grain growing?
Yeah.
On what scale? Are you specialising in ancient varieties or something?
Yeah.
Ah, right. Okay, got
yeah,
it.
Exactly.
Okay.
So
it's
the plan,
experimental thing.
I also work with Grant and Community Gardeners. And at Grant and Community Gardeners, they've been growing wheat on street corners for the last
Seriously?
8 or 9 years where
Why?
The council housing is. Why not? It's interesting.
Oh, it is interesting.
It's
I just
part
want,
of Scotland the Bread Soil to Slice project.
Well, that's what I was wondering.
Yeah.
I wonder if they actually harvest it at any stage and
yes,
do something.
Yes,
they do.
So what happened was local neighbours were harvesting it and then they learned from Scotland the Bread how to make sourdough bread. And now we have a bakery. So in Granton, we have a community bakery that sells bread on a pay-what-you-can basis. In amongst council housing, you don't often see a sourdough offering there. It's done out the back window of a community centre. So then what we decided was to start taking the wheat that's grown on the street corners, saving the seed from it, and growing a bigger patch here. So we grew 500 square metres last year of that wheat, and it did pretty well. We also planted up a history of wheat plot. So we started from Emer and Einkorn all the way up to new varieties that are coming out of the James Hutton Institute.
Okay.
And then that 500 square metres of wheat, We have then expanded again by just saving the seed and growing on more.
So this is not just a resource for local people. You can also use this for university students, for James Hutton and all that kind of thing. They can come here and play and do stuff at the same time.
I think because we're an urban farm, it's a bit different in that what we want, as well as being able to grow lots of good food and feed lots of people and everything, is we want people to understand the food system better. So we want people to come on and learn about regenerative farming, learn about the soil, learn about worms, learn about the birds, learn about the insects and all that. But also there is, it's quite handy for quite a lot of working with different academic people. So we're also working with Edinburgh University to see if it's possible to create a zero carbon loaf of bread.
How would you go about doing that?
Aye, so biochar, apparently, because it's a bit of a carbon sink.
Okay, biochar being?
It's a way of creating, I think, like activated charcoal. But so you're making charcoal at very, very high temperatures. You're creating something that's very, very porous, that absorbs lots of things and kind of holds nutrients in the soil. Mm-hmm. And so you add that to the soil and it helps to sort of retain nutrients in the soil and carbon. I don't think we'll create a zero-carbon loaf this year. It's our first year of farming and we're shifting.
How would you bake a zero-carbon loaf? Because basically you've got energy coming in on that.
Well, first of all, you're looking at the whole life cycle assessment, right? So you're looking at from where your seed comes from, how you're growing it, what's happening in the field, how you're transporting it, where it's being threshed, dried and milled, and how it's being baked. So we're saving already because, I mean, most bakeries get their flour from Canada and previously Ukraine.
Yeah.
So if we've got flour growing here and we're potentially cycling it down the bike path to Grantham Bakery, that's already taken out a certain amount of carbon. Then if you manage to develop your bakery, so we're the bakery that is in Granton is looking to get a new site where you're making energy efficiencies between the heat that comes off the ovens being transferred into another kind of energy, or where, again, not an area of expertise of mine, but that's what I understand. And if you use biochar, you may be able to offset some of the energy costs there. So I am not a scientist, but we do have a team of them working with us. And we won't be doing this instantly, but it's also an idea to try and put that out there as like looking at the life cycle assessment, looking at where the gains and losses can or can't be made, and trying to say to people, look, here's a model that we can be working with and changing the food carbon footprint.
There is a certain irony here, because you can hear that in the background.
Oh,
you are on the flight path for Edinburgh Airport.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about tiny, tiny, minuscule amounts of carbon, etc., in a loaf.
I know.
And that is going past every 3 minutes.
I know. This area here, which is the northernmost field, is quite an important, because it's part of the fourth restoration project, if you like, but the idea of certain types of migrating migrating coastal wading birds and nesting
that rattling
birds.
Noise is somebody going past with a trolley and a saw.
He's making a dead hedge in the allotments.
Okay, good.
He's diligently going up and down that hill every day, and there's a tree that fell down and he's
good
picking
man
up the bits.
Okay.
So yeah, so this is quite an important habitat, so we're trying to discourage people and their dogs from going on here with some success. It'll get more successful this summer when we're going to have Highland cattle in there.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have a small herd of Highland cattle in here that will be grazing primarily for biodiversity. So we've got a wildflower meadow strip in here. They'll be coming in and grazing. The habitat there, the grass has to be kept really short because it's for the type of birds that need to see very far in case their prey is coming. There's no point us going in with machinery and keeping the grass very, very short because that just scares everything away. So the cattle do that job down there and kind of create nice tussocks and a nice habitat for hopefully lots of creatures. We do have wildlife cameras in there, so we're able to get feed on what's changing. And this middle field, we're also going to put in agrofort. This is going to be part wildlife habitat, part crop growing, but probably not in the near future. We'll start to put in agroforestry strips here, though, in the next couple of years. And here you can also see we've put in ponds.
Agroforestry strips, basically, it's like corridors. So you plant trees in rows and then you plant your crops between those borders.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Okay.
And the idea being that you're sort of creating a system that's a bit more like nature. It's not natural to have, like we have in a lot of conventional farming, massive areas where there's nothing growing except for the crop and generally the soil's being, monoculture, the ground's being depleted. So the idea is that the trees help to prevent flooding, they help to stabilise the soil, they help create high, healthy mycorrhizal nutrients under the soil, and also they provide there's fruit trees in here, there might be things for fuel, there might be willow that people can harvest basket for basketry, there's hazel for coppicing.
God, the wind as you come round the corner of the hedge.
Yeah, so that's another reason why the agroforestry strips are really important, because they basically will cut the wind down across the crop. And I mean, generally, even where we don't have the agroforestry strips, we're building a lot of natural wind barriers using hedgerows. So yeah. There's extensive hedgerows.
This always fascinates me, the way, because I mean, just standing where we are, the path, it doesn't bifurcate, it trifurcates. It goes in three separate ways. People make up their minds, this is the way I'm going to go.
The desire lines, yeah. So the Market Garden, this is its second year of its community-supported agriculture scheme, which is when people in the local community sign up to receive for the growing season a weekly veg box. The way we're doing it is kind of in recognition of the fact that we're wedged between some very wealthy neighbourhoods and some areas that are in the sort of in that index of multiple deprivation, some of the worst in Scotland. So we, in recognition of that, we have a solidarity model whereby if a veg box, let's say, costs 16 quid a week, we ask people who can afford to and who want to, it's completely voluntary, to pay 20% or 50% more, so that those who prefer to pay 50% or 20% less can do that. So just trying to always keep an eye on how our food is affordable. Yeah. But we also, there's a number of food pantries and community meals in North Edinburgh that we also provide veg for. And we work very closely with Edinburgh Community Food, who deliver boxes of food to people in the community who can't afford. We're always trying to make sure that there are lots of different ways that our food can get into the community, as well as lots of different ways that people from the local community can come and get involved on site.
This is basically from the Academy of the Bleeding Obvious, but food makes a community.
Absolutely, yeah.
The growing of food, the sharing of food, you know, the appreciation of it. Talking about it, the sort of democratic parceling of it out, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and also, like, at a time when everybody's facing a cost of living crisis and everybody's talking about food insecurity, I think what we would like to be showcasing is abundance and creating a place where there's actually an abundance of food and being able to say to people, we have food, you can eat it. As simple as that.
Lisa Houston, Community Coordinator at Lauriston Agroecology Farm in Edinburgh. If you're interested in finding out more about the farm and the various things happening there, have a look at their website. It's lauristonfarm.scot. On the website, there's a video of this poem written and performed by Iona Lee called The Seed Kissed. Iona has very kindly given us permission to share it with you now. Have a listen to this, but until the next time, I'm Mark Stephen. Thanks for listening.
The Seed Kissed. Quite unassuming, this weather-beaten box. This once discarded ark. Forgotten. Was left collecting cobwebs in the fallow dark. But look at what's locked inside. Keepsakes from seasons past. The seed-kissed sewing kit now sits on this once forsaken seam between the Firth of Forth and the outskirts of our city, feeding a dream. Think of it like a library, containing books that could be written, conserving what will be, given half the chance. Seeds, at once alive and latent, waiting with the patience of grain for winter's revolution, for faithful spring's refrain to do their life work. They have imagination. So do the people here. The curiosity of water. Can you see the orchard in that empty field? What stirs beneath the earth? Pass today through a riddle. We know the future from the past. They've planted willow, witch elm, aspen, alder, asked, what if? Why not? Let's try. Next year they'll harvest sweet corn, sweet pea and dumpling pumpkin from the seed-kissed soil. Let them feed you a secret. Abundance is endless and ever-replenishing. It's a perpetual motion, organic machine. Like that old adage of rice on a chessboard. The hours on a sunflower's clock face add up to infinity. Community's the cure for nihilism when apathy is routine. The bee's ignition. To restart the garden, it begins with a spark. A bulb, the seed of an idea. Someone to lift the lid and see that what remains in the box is hope. Homegrown. This disenchanted landscape can disclose, unforgetting what it's always known, that there was never nothing here. Only everything. And that matters. For what's a stretch of barren land but an understory? What's a seed if not the promise of a tree? And what is one? There's never one, only many. So say, what is woodland but nature's green-hinged invitation? That canopy to which the future climbs, concert hall for an orchestra of songbirds. And what is a tune made of? But time.